Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hi everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's really great to have you company for another episode of the show. Now, my guest today is Dr. Hitesh Doshi, and I have known Hitesh now for, 8 or 9 years. He's a really, really lovely man. He's one of nature's good guys. He's a thorough gentleman. And in addition to being a thorough gentleman, he's also a very, very good clinician and a very good practice owner as well. And one of the things that I was really fascinated by Hitesh is his ability to maintain a strong clinical interest and maintain a really good practice at the same time. And what I noticed is that there's a lot of dentists that actually really enjoy clinical work, and sometimes they might feel that, you know, the juggle between clinical excellence and business excellence is a hard juggle. And in this episode, Hitesh talks about how he's been able to achieve both of those, how he's maintained, you know, his clinical interests. He's been able to continue to expand his clinical repertoire, do the type of dentistry that he loves to do, and maintain a thriving, profitable practice. Now, Hitesh has a couple of superpowers in my mind from a business point of view. One, he's a tremendous leader. He's really good with people. He's had to learn that skill. He's had to develop that skill, but he's become a very, very good leader of people. His second superpower is he's very good actually at understanding numbers and how the numbers of his business work and paying attention to those numbers. And I think the third skill that I think Hitesh has really mastered is his ability to grow. You know, his practice started off as one chair operating, and he's about to put in his fourth chair. And I think his ability to manage that growth is really, really good. And of course, that's been achieved over a period of time. And what I love about Hitesh is his practice has been created in his own vision. So the practice that he loves is what he's created, and it serves his needs very, very well. So in this episode, there's lots of good stuff here, lots of good insights, lots of pearls of wisdom. And I want to say thank you to Hitesh for being so generous to come on to the show and share all of those pearls of wisdom with you. So without any further ado, here's Dr. Hitesh Doshi. Hitesh, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It is fantastic to have you here, mate. It's been a while coming, but we got here.
Thank you, Jesse. Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor to be here today. Hopefully, I can share some tips and tricks with other dental practice owners, Jesse, that I learned along the way of being a dental practice owner.
Well, mate, you run a really good practice at Endeavour Hills in Victoria, and we're going to explore all the things that you do and how you do it and why you've been so successful. But before we get into the ins and outs of your practice ownership journey, I thought it'd be interesting just to get a bit about your personal journey and your background, you know, a bit about the life and times of Hitesh Doshi.
Sure, Jesse. As you've known me for years, I was born and raised in India. I did my dental studies, a bachelor's degree in India. And then I wanted to explore the world, get global exposure. So I decided to come to Australia back in 2005. I took up master's studies in public health and I did my ADC along the way to be registered as a dentist in Australia. And then I started working in Royal Dental Hospital back in 2007. That was my first job as a new grad. It was very interesting working there, as you can imagine. Primary care department, emergency department. I saw quite a lot of variety of cases. And from there on, I worked in a community health center for a year or so, and then transitioned into a private practice, Jesse, in Brunswick in Victoria. The practice that I worked in Brunswick was owned by a corporate company back then who also owned another practice in Endeavour Hills. And they asked me if I could be a principal dentist for that practice, to lead that practice for them. I took on that opportunity back in 2010. I started working as a lead dentist part-time. And that practice was a very rundown practice, open 3 days a week, Jesse, one chair. The corporates had it with other practices as a package, I suppose. So they never wanted that practice in the first place. But yeah, and I tried to turn it around, but being naive and inexperienced in managing dental practices, I don't think I did well. So I decided to buy a dental practice somewhere else, and I resigned from my position as a lead dentist. And interestingly, that time corporates came to me and said, oh, if you want to be an owner, how about buying this practice? Yeah, so then again, I was inexperienced, Jesse. I didn't know what I was doing. So I'm like, okay, let's do it. I'll buy this and I'll turn it around in no time. And that's how I became a practice owner. It's interesting, actually, this month marks the 10th year of my ownership at wow. Totally Teeth and Never Heals. Yes.
Oh, congratulations, mate. I didn't realize that. That's a wonderful milestone.
I didn't know that until yesterday when I was thinking about this, Jesse.
There you go. Oh, wow. Well, that's quite the journey then, Hitesh. So tell us a bit about the practice when you bought it. What was it like? You know, when you bought it from the corporate, what did you end up buying? What did you get for your money?
So essentially when I started as a lead dentist, as I mentioned before, it was running only 3 days a week, Jesse. So from that until 2014 when I bought it, it was one chair full-time practice. We had one other associate working with us a couple of days a week. So still not profitable sort of practice. But yeah, it was slowly getting there. And then in my early days, Jesse, as quite a lot of clinicians think that just doing a good clinical dentistry will make this practice thrive. I understand that great clinical dentistry or clinical excellence is vital, but that's not the only ingredient for a successful or thriving practice. So I had to get all the skills afterwards.
When we were talking off air a moment ago, you are a really good clinical dentist. You've got a wonderful set of hands. You're renowned for doing great clinical dentistry. You know, I think it's fair to say you enjoy clinical dentistry as well. Is that reasonable?
100%, Jesse. I think a lot of dentists are, you know, just clinicians and not managers by nature, and I'm one of those. A lot of dentists are managers naturally and they can run practice effortlessly, whereas people like me have to hone those skills, you know, management skills, marketing skills, HR skills, people management and communication and all that. So yes, you're absolutely right. I love clinical dentistry, and I'm actually doing my master's studies in implant dentistry now, so that's a proof that I still enjoy handwork and dentistry.
So Hitesh, let's talk a little bit about the practice, and given that you really have a strong clinical background and you enjoy clinical dentistry, I think for a lot of people, you know, certainly a lot of the people that we work with, and you know a lot of the people that we work with, they really enjoy the business side of things and perhaps a little less on the clinical side. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really important to cater for those people that actually really enjoy clinical work, want to do that really well and have a successful business as in addition to that. It doesn't have to be, you know, mutually exclusive. So I wanted to ask you a bit about those early days of practice ownership. What did you find was easier to learn? What was challenging? What were those early days for you like as a practice owner?
Look, the first couple of years of being an owner, I was trying to, you know, figure it out myself where things are not working. And I think the turning point for me was finding you, Jesse, back in 2016, 2017, when we met in one of the conferences. But yeah, look, in early days, important thing was to find the gaps in my skills and knowledge for management side of the things, not clinical side of the things. And one of the thing was leadership. So I was good at probably primary leadership, leading myself, but not very good at secondary or tertiary leadership, you know, leading others or creating leaders. So identifying that was eye-opening for me, that if you're going to run a team of people, you need to be a really good leader first and acquire those skills, you know. And that was one thing. Second thing was learning about numbers, so tracking things. You know, you can't just be sitting passively as a business owner and think everything is working, you know, the money is flowing through the accounts and we are successful. So we have to be consciously tracking things, measuring things, so that we can improve and get on the right track. It's like sailing a ship, right? Being a practice owner.
Yeah.
You need to course your track. You need to make adjustments where it's necessary and make sure we are looking at the destination while we're sailing the ship as well. So
Hitesh, one of the words that comes to mind just listening to you speak there is intentionality, you know, being intentional with what you're doing. And you said you can't just kind of sit there passively. You've got to be, you know, engaged with your business. That is something that perhaps some practice owners struggle with. They kind of think, oh, I love my clinical dentistry. If I could just sit in these kind of four walls of my surgery and just do clinical dentistry, that would be my nirvana. Do you think that that's really possible, or do you think that as a business owner we kind of have to, like, if you want to be in the four walls and only in the four walls, can you be a business owner, do you think, or do you think you need to kind of look outside the four walls of your surgery?
Well, you definitely need to look out of four walls in the first place to create the leaders and systems and things like that before you can go back to your four walls and do clinical dentistry. But you first few years you have to go out, be a leader, create leaders who can handle things in your clinic, who can manage things, and then you can just again focus back on clinical dentistry. If you're just going to be a good dentist and everything is going to fall in place magically, it doesn't happen, unfortunately.
It would be nice if it did, wouldn't it?
Yeah. As you always said, Jesse, there's no silver bullet for running a successful practice.
If there was, mate, I've been looking for one. I just haven't found it, right? I just don't think it exists. Yeah, in the early days, you had one chair, right?
Yeah.
How many chairs do you have now?
So we have three chairs and the fourth one is going soon. So when I say one chair, we always had two chairs, but it was running only one chair at a time.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, now we've got three chairs. We are a team of five clinicians, Jesse, and nine support staff. So team of 14 now and growing.
Growing, which is great. Yeah. And what I wanted to ask you about was the stages of growth that you've experienced, because, again, people listening to this might be starting off with that. They might be in a one or two chair practice and, you know, wanting to add a chair or two along the way.
Sure.
What do you think was the contributor to your growth? What allowed you initially to go, I'm confident enough to kind of, you know, fill the second chair or add a third chair and now fourth? What's given you the confidence to kind of make those leaps?
So first and foremost is to have a vision, Jesse. When you're just doing clinical dentistry and if you're just not sure where you want to get to. So I think in my journey, first thing was to set out a clear vision of what I want to be, where I want to be, and then finding a path. So when the clinic was only doing one chair a day, we had to figure out why are we not able to grow, where are the leaks, are we retaining enough patients, are we getting new patients, and slowly started learning all those things and measuring all those things so that we can tweak things to grow.
You touched on something actually really interesting, Hitesh, and I think this is actually one of your superpowers, and that is you're quite analytical. You're very good with numbers. You're able to identify trends in numbers and so on. What has learning the numbers given you an ability to understand about your business? What do you know better about your business as a result of being across the data?
I think the numbers give you sort of a bird's eye view of your practice, isn't it? It tells you a snapshot of what's happening. We do track a lot of leading indicators and lagging indicators, as you would appreciate. Being a nurturer in terms of my personality, I don't discuss a lot of revenue numbers and all those daily numbers with my team, but that doesn't mean we're not aiming for the goals. We actually track a lot of leading indicators, like, you know, what's happening with the case tracking, what is happening with Google reviews, what's happening. So that will have a result down the track for the practice. So analyzing numbers is critical for me to understand where we are doing well, where we're not doing well, where do we need to fix things, and what's working well that we need to protect and maintain things. Yeah, and then the numbers in terms of profit and loss as well, Jesse, you always point out that I'm good at expense management and things like that for practice. So I think it is important. Numbers are important.
I think actually your financial management is one of your superpowers, and you're very, very good at that. And I say that with the, you know, as the highest compliment I can pay, because for a practice that has grown, you know, from one chair to two to three and now four, your ability to achieve financial returns, outsized financial returns from from your infrastructure is really, really, really good. And I think you've done a tremendous job there.
Thank you, Jesse. I always think that a dollar saved is a dollar earned, isn't it?
Yeah, well, absolutely.
So we need to keep track of both, not just increasing the revenue, but also what we're spending to get there.
Yeah, and what's left over. So just on that journey, who was the first significant hire that you made on that journey from, you know, one chair ultimately through to three and soon to be four? What was the big hire that made the big difference?
I think the associate dentist. So my first hire was actually my practice manager, Jesse, that is still with me after she's just completed her 13 years with me. So Dana has been with me for 13 years now. So she was my first hire. I think when we changed the gears, having an associate dentist to free me up from clinical dentistry a little bit was critical, because I was working, 5.5 days a week at some stage, and getting close to burnout, working hard in clinical dentistry and then doing the business side of the things on the weekend. So yeah, that changed, that leverage from our associate dentist changed the things. And then second point in turning point was having OHTs in the team. So now we've got two OHTs that work alongside the dentist. So we've got two dentists every day and an OHT every day. That changed our practice quite a lot as well, because now that frees me up to do things that I love doing in clinical dentistry, and I can grow in that side of the thing as well. So
in terms of having productive clinicians, dentists or OHTs, associates or OHTs, how have you managed to achieve that? Because one of the things that we hear a lot of practice owners get frustrated by perhaps is, I've got such and such a dentist sitting in the chair. They're really nice, but I can't really afford to keep them on because they're just not earning enough money to cover their own their own expenditure. What's been your secret or thoughts around getting people to be productive but maintaining that really nice ethos? Because that's the thing, your ethos at your practice is so lovely, it's warm, it's friendly, and as you say, you don't really talk about numbers so much, and it sounds counterintuitive not to talk about the numbers, and yet you've got productive associates. So what's been your secret there?
First thing is culture, Jesse. Of the not just for the clinician, but for overall practice, you would understand that maintaining culture is not by an accident. We constantly and actively monitor our culture, and we make sure our values and behaviors that we stand by is followed every day. So that creates an environment for everyone to grow. Having a good culture in the workplace, I think, allows people to shine and perform their best. That's first thing. Second thing is mentoring them as well. So having that relationship, especially with our associates and OHTs, opens them up to come to us and ask for any feedback. And at the same time, they are also thriving to become the best version of themselves. It's not they're doing it because they have to hit the goal. They want to become better version of themselves, and giving them clear goals, guidelines, and helping them how to get there, identifying the hurdles and things for them sometimes if they don't identify it themselves. So that has helped them to grow, and in turn practice to grow as well.
And just while we're talking about your clinical team for a second, you mentioned OHTs.
Yeah.
What I find with OHTs, some people are really pro OHT, some people are really anti OHT.
Yeah.
I think it all depends on the practice and what you're trying to achieve. So I'm kind of a bit, sure, depending on the outcome you're trying to get to. But what's been the benefit of an OHT in your practice? You mentioned freeing up your time to focus on what you love, but what other benefits have they brought to the practice for you?
Well, first and foremost, our OHTs are very good at educating patients. A lot of clinicians don't spend enough time. I'm guilty for that as well, Jesse. I'm just in and out,
Me too.
My job. But yeah, they spend a lot of time educating patients, and that creates that connection for the patients with our practice. We get a lot of Google reviews because of our OHT spending all the time communicating with them and creating the connection. So that's first thing. Second thing is because they can free up your diary from checkup and cleans and kids and all that, we can focus on higher value work or more sort of a productive appointments for ourselves and complex treatment for ourselves. So for me, I think it also depends. Jesse, you know how you said some people are really anti OHDs and anti hygiene department, and some people love it. I think it comes down to what a practice owner actually wants, isn't it? That's their end goal. If my end goal being a clinician is to be able to do complex works and enjoy doing that, then OHDs are a no-brainer for me because I think they free me up for doing all those things. And I enjoy seeing their growth as well. The OHDs have been with us for about 3.5-4 years now, and they've grown along their journey as well. They take up quite a lot of clinical work that they didn't used to do 3 years ago. So, yeah, you enjoy seeing their growth.
Yeah, which is fantastic, and it's really rewarding. And another thing that I think is really rewarding, coming back to Dana, is she's been with you 13 years, which is remarkable.
Isn't it?
And she, yeah, and she's
lucky.
This is what I want to get to. I think there's a bit more than just luck to it.
Correct, yes, yeah.
She's a really good operator and she's a nice person and all those sorts of things. And what do you think has contributed to you retaining your team? Because I know you've retained a lot of people, Dana being the longest one there.
100%, yeah. Most of our team has been there for over 5 years now. So
yeah, so talk to us a bit about how you're retaining your team, because a lot of people struggle to hold on to their good people. What are you doing to keep your people?
So Jesse, one of the things, once I started growing from team of 3 to 4 and 6 and 8, was culture. Coming back to the culture, because when we were a smaller team, the culture was by default. It wasn't intentional. As we started growing, we noticed that a new team member comes and brings their own values and behaviors. And unless we protect our culture, our own values and behaviors, and get them to fit into the team, that will affect the rest of the team. So that was an enlightening moment for me, where I started understanding how to maintain culture, how to embed culture in the team. We do a lot of activities around maintaining the culture. So we do this culture day once a year, where we sit down with the team and, you know, talk to them about values and behaviors that we stand for. We do a lot of mentoring over the culture issues as well. And if somebody is not the right fit, we actively try and help them to fit into our team. So we try and explain them, this is what we stand for. Can you please come and this side of the line, you know,
yeah,
sort of thing. And if they don't fit, or if they're not right fit, then we have to make sure we identify it early and, you know, probably help them find a place where they would fit better than our team, sort of thing. Because if we didn't do that, if the culture sinks, it's going to be a trouble for staff retention and performance of everyone. But yeah, every time we do the mentoring with our staff and the rest of the team, one common theme we always get is they enjoy coming to the work. And then that's what we love hearing.
So the feedback you're getting from the team is they love coming to work. Obviously, mm-hmm. they enjoy, you know, their workmates, and they enjoy the work that they do. Is there anything else that the team are saying to you that they love about coming to work?
So the teamwork as well, you know, they appreciate how we give feedback to them. There are a couple of ways, right? If we don't challenge them, everyone will come enjoy coming to work. But
yeah,
that's not what we do. We still make sure we challenge them, we make them grow, but in a manner that everyone is aligned, that nobody's offended, nobody thinks that the feedback given is to tell them off, kind of thing, you know. So we had to work slowly our ways of doing things, and eventually we set the standards, we've got the codes that we follow, and it works very well now.
Yeah.
So very happy.
Yeah, very good. And at the helm of that team is you, and you mentioned a little while ago that you're a nurturer by nature, and of course that refers to one of the five leadership voices that we sometimes talk about. And for those interested, you can find out about those five leadership voices. We did a podcast, I think it was about a year ago, regarding five leadership voices, but you can go to giant.tv and find that out. But tell us a little bit about what a nurturer leadership style looks like. What are the advantages of that? Are there any downsides to being a nurturer? And then we can talk about a couple of the other voices as well, just to round it out a bit. But
sure.
You're a very mature nurturer, mate.
Oh, Jesse, thank you. Oh, being a nurturer, I'll start with the downsides of the nurturer, Jesse.
Okay, all right.
The downside of the nurturer is, they sometimes don't take actions that can offend others. So a typical example would be a C player or a person who's not a culture fit in the team. A nurturer would try to get them on this side of the line so that they are a good culture fit first. But if they're still not fitting, nurturer will take longer to get them out of the team compared to the other voices, where they would be like, okay, this is not the person I want on the team. You're out tomorrow, something like that. So that's a downside of the nurturer. But being conscious about those sorts of downside also frees you up, because that means you are, when you're making decisions, strategic decisions, you're like, okay, I'm nurturer. Am I thinking it in the correct direction? This is what I want to achieve. This is my limitations. This is how I'm going to handle this situation. That's the downside. The upside, though, Jesse, is that nurturer always thinks about the rest of the team. They think, if I'm going to implement a change, I would always be mindful of how it's going to affect every single person. Is there anything that I need to do to prepare them for accepting this change and all that sort of stuff? So usually when the change is implemented, it's not as harsh or hard on the team, because it's been well thought, well planned for on how they're going to accept the change or all that. Also, I think personal relationships, when there's a conflict between the team members and things like that, the nurturer can pick it up quite well compared to the other traits, I suppose. So we can diffuse the situation before it gets out of the control, I guess.
Yeah. So being aware of your own leadership voice, has that given you insight into how to be the best version of yourself, like know thyself kind of attitude?
100%, Jesse. It changed the way I look at myself as a leader now. So that was it a webinar that we did with Giant TV a couple of years ago. That was a game changing for me, especially as a nurturer, because now I know what I am as a leader, you know, or where I stand for as a leader in this big picture. Yeah.
Yeah. And just for the listeners, there's these five leadership voices. So nurturer being one, which is Hitesh's style. And then there's, creatives, there's connectors, there's what they call guardians, and then there's pioneers. And you can, obviously we've all got all of these voices within us, but we tend to have a primary voice or a default mechanism that we operate by. Mm-hmm. And Hitesh's is a really lovely one, because he's a warm, kind soul. All the other voices have their strengths as well.
Correct,
and all the voices have their drawbacks. So there's no one voice that's better or worse than the others. It's just who you are and knowing where your inherent strengths lie and being mindful of where your inherent weaknesses lie as well.
Absolutely.
What's been your view around hiring, Hitesh? How have you managed that so well? Because again, to keep people for 5 years, you've obviously found good people at the outset.
I always believe that people want to give their best when they come and work with us. It's not that they want to ruin our day, as you say, when they come to work. So having them for 5 years, it's not just that I hired them and then they were the right fit. It also means that I had to work with them along the way to make sure they're the right fit. So I've made mistakes along the way in hiring as well. I had to let go of UC players along the way as well. It's not like I haven't made mistakes, Jesse. It's just, but as you do this often, you would understand what sort of person would fit in the team better. So when I'm doing a hiring, I'm always mindful of our set of values and culture and behavior, that is this person going to be the right fit for the team, right fit for the position? And once we hire them, everyone is different. Obviously, when you have a team of more than 10 people, there's going to be a little bit of differences amongst the team members. So we have to make sure that we empower the team members as well to handle those situations and to get that team member to fit in the team. So it's not just hiring. I think it's after hiring as well that you have to make sure that it fits in and it works, not just saying, okay, bye-bye, it's not working.
Have you made some mistakes along the way?
In the practice ownership journey, you mean? Or are you talking about hiring people?
Yeah, practice ownership journey.
If I had to go back and take the first step, to buy a practice, I would have bought a profitable practice, Jesse.
Yeah, okay.
Not the one that took me a while to turn around, you know. But I didn't know what I was doing back then. So that was probably a big lesson for me as well, that to learn about the numbers.
For those people who might be struggling with a practice now, who might be going, oh my God, you know, is this thing ever going to work?
Yeah.
What advice would you have for those people that might be listening going, Hitesh, just throw me a bone, give me something to feel hopeful about?
Yeah, I think the first thing is ask for help, Jesse. Whatever challenges we face as a practice owner, I'm sure somebody else out there would have faced similar situations and they would have worked the way out. So seeking help, in my case, it was getting a coaching and mentoring from yourself. But that is something that I'd advise people strongly who are like me, who are not naturally management style people. They're more clinicians and struggling with the management of the practice, to find the help, seek help, to learn and grow and, you know, work out, rather than being bogged down like, oh, this is never going to work, you know, find answers, look for help, I think is the answer.
Yeah. I if I might add to that, one of the things, again, sure, Hitesh, that I think you've done really well is you've been able to act on what you've learned. It's all good to have a strategy. So that the gap between having a strategy and achieving the outcomes is in that implementation piece, that execution of the strategy piece. And I think, you know, again, my observation of you over the years and having known you for a long time now is that you're very, very good at taking action on what you learn. And I think...
Thank you, Jesse. Yeah. I think I'm a slow implementer, but I do implement things for sure.
Yeah, but that's the thing though, isn't it? There's that great expression, and this is a Tony Robbins saying, so I just need to give credit there. We overestimate what we can achieve in a year, but we underestimate what we can achieve in a decade. So
I can't agree more on that, Jesse.
Yeah.
It's very well said, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think that, yeah, that's a, I'm pretty sure it's Tony Robbins that says that. Hitesh, just, you mentioned that you're doing some master's work in implantology.
Yep.
Tell me a bit about that. What are you loving? What are you learning? What's getting you excited in that space?
So, you know, as we grow over our career, things change, our priorities change, Jesse. And for me, the next sort of, where I see myself in the next 5 to 10 years, I wanted to do more complex dentistry, and this was the part. So I do a lot of, I did the orthodontic fellowship about 10 years ago, and I do quite a lot of orthodontic work as well in the practice. But I think implant dentistry is where I want to grow more and eventually practice just in complex work of implant dentistry and ortho in next 5 years' time. So that's what made me take up this course, Jesse. I've been doing implant dentistry for a while, but this master's degree would probably be a bit of a feather on the head.
Yeah.
And a lot of learning. It's actually in Germany, in Frankfurt. So the reason I took up that course was people from 14 other countries in my batch, dentists from 14 other countries who are all more than 10 years of experience. So a lot of learning from each other as well, apart from obviously the professors there.
I think that's one of the fundamental things, isn't it? Whether it's clinical work or business work, when you hang around smart people, you're going to pick up a few things, whether it's around implants or ortho or business or anything else, right? So,
100%. As you say, find your tribe.
Find your tribe, exactly. Find your tribe and hang out there. And I'm a really strong believer that put smart people in a room, get out of the way, let them talk, and good stuff happens.
Magic happens, yeah.
So with the implant dentistry, Hitesh, what's been the hardest thing? You know, is it getting back into the study? Is it the volume of work? What's been tough?
It's been about 15 years since I did a formal study, Jesse. We do a lot of courses, weekend courses and things like that. But going back to all these research papers and doing master's thesis and recording the cases that we do to the university standard, you know, just brought my memories from the undergrad studies. Like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But I'm learning a lot as well.
Too. So brushing up on all your clinical photography and all that sort of
exactly
stuff.
Exactly right. Yep. Exactly right.
Yeah, there you go. Wow, that's amazing. Hitesh, as you say, you've always enjoyed clinical dentistry, and for a lot of people, there's this kind of false idea that to have a successful practice, you've got to focus exclusively on the business. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, obviously you've got to focus on the business. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to have a successful practice. But being able to balance that and maintaining your interests and your enjoyment with clinical work, I think is something that you've achieved really well. You've got that beautiful blend of clinical dentistry and business. And you've created a business, I think, that really suits you and yep. what your definition of success is. And so first I want to say, you know, that's really well done and congratulations to you around
thank
that.
Thank you, Chelsea.
But I wanted just to wrap up our conversation a little bit about that, is about your thoughts on the different definitions of success, you know, because your definition of success would be different to mine and mine would be different to the next person's and so on and so forth. But tell me your philosophy around building a practice that suits you.
I think first thing is, Jesse, to know yourself, to answer your question. You know, as you rightly said, everyone looks at success differently. You need to know yourself to figure out what you want to achieve, why you want to achieve, and what success looks like for yourself. Because every time you go out and meet others, you would be inspired, like, okay, oh, this person is doing tantra practice, this person is doing, you know, something else. And you might think, oh, am I successful? Am I looking to achieve that as my next milestone? But then when you sit down and think what is important to you, what matters to you the most, helps you understand and gives you clarity, like that gives you satisfaction of what you've achieved so far rather than being bogged down by the other things.
I think that point of knowing what your own personality desires or what your heart's desire is really, really key. And again, what I really love, Hitesh, about your practice is you've created it in your own image. You've created a practice that really is suitable for you. And you know, you get to enjoy the things that you love to do, and I think that that's amazing.
A lot of that credit goes to you, Jesse. I should let the listeners know that I learned a lot from you along the way.
It's very kind, mate. I appreciate those kind words. And as I said earlier, it's one thing to be able to teach those things to you, but you've been able to pick up the ball and run with it and implement it. So I think the credit goes there. Mate, as we wrap up, any final thoughts you want to leave the listeners today about as they go about their own practice journey? Any final pearls of wisdom? Any things that we should have spoken about but I forgot to ask or something like that?
No, again, I think one thing that I would like to point out for the dental practice owners like me, who are mainly clinicians, not very good at management side of the thing, is understanding power of delegation. Great clinicians always like to keep everything to themselves, you know, do everything themselves, and they don't realize the lost opportunity if they had allowed things to be delegated. So it's not just giving the tasks out, it's actually empowering your team to take ownership and grow along with you, because then the growth of the practice would be fourfold rather than just by yourself. So yeah, and that frees up the time to do things that you want to do for your growth as well. So yeah, that was one thing I think I would like to share with the listeners as well, understand the delegation.
And I'll just add to that, how you've brought your team on your journey with you, mate, is, you know, really wonderful. And I think I'm sure you don't mind me saying this, I think your team have been, yeah, really played a pivotal role in the growth of the practice as well.
100%. I wouldn't have been here without the support of my team and growth of my team.
Yeah. And equally, they wouldn't be where they are without you. So it's a nice, neat circle.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win, absolutely. Hey, Hitesh, we might wrap up there, mate. Thank you again for taking the time to come out and hang out with us on the podcast, mate.
It's an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, I've had the great joy of knowing you now for a lot of years, and it's such a thrill to see you achieve everything you desire, mate, and kudos to you. You've worked hard, you've earned it, and from all of us here, mate, we salute you.
Thank you, Jesse. Thank you for the kind words, and thank you for inviting me as well, Jesse. Your podcast has been helpful to so many practice owners around Australia and New Zealand. I speak to a lot of dentists around, and they all appreciate the resource that you've created through this podcast. So thank you for doing this as well for us, Jesse.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, mate. I'll look forward to catching up soon, mate.
Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.